both anti-fascist research people. We both have research.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British wars. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I killed my share of Injuns in a thousand different fights. I was there at the Little Big Horn. I heard many men lying, I saw many more a-dying, but I anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For I stole California from the Mexican land, fought in the bloody Civil War. Yes, I even killed my brothers and so many others, but I ain't a marching anymore. For I marched to the battles of the German trench in a war that was bound to end all wars. Oh, I must have killed a million men and now they want me back again, but I ain't a marching anymore. It's always the old to lead us to the wars, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with the saber and the gun. Tell me, is it worth it all?
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview with Joan Gussaw. This interview is part of the new radio production, Heartland Stories. Brought to you by the folks that did Rootstock Radio, Heartland Stories is a weekly show featuring interviews about the future of food, farming, and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Joan Gussaw.
It is with much honor and pleasure to be speaking with Joan Di Gussaw, recognized by almost every good food influential of the last 60 years, as courageously taking on the profession of nutrition and changing it. I'd love to quote Marion Nestle. She said, "Oh, Joan, she was the first. She was the first. She was the first." And then the other quote I love is the New York Times, who said, "The matriarch of eat locally, think globally food movement." And Dr. Gussaw is Professor Emeritus of the School of Nutrition and Education at the Teachers College at Columbia University, and just told me she is still teaching a class, albeit online. She is a teacher, a mentor, an author of 6 books, a speaker, an environmentalist, a gardener, and of course, a food change agent. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Joan Di Gussaw.
Well, thank you, Teresa, and what an introduction. My goodness, I can't live up to that.
Well, you know, I think it's so important because I know that you're 91 now, and I think a lot of our listeners are younger, and I think a lot of people are forgetting the pioneers, and you are such a pioneer that I really wanted to make sure everyone understood just what a great pioneer you are. You know, I have been dying to ask you this question for the longest time, and that is, it really occurred to me that, you know, you got your doctorate at Columbia University, and then you became head of the Teachers College in nutrition. Then, you know, with all the reading I've done about you and the Feeding Web, Lessons in Nutritional Ecology, you, after, you know, writing a couple of books, I read a quote, and it said that you were a thorn in the side of nutritionists.
Crazy. Some of my students thought I was crazy, actually.
I just wonder, how did you survive those early days, and how did you even hold on to your job? I mean, today they might have just fired you.
Well, it's interesting. I've thought about that. I mean, you shouldn't even ask that. You should even ask how I how I became chair of the department. I mean, I was chair of the department 2 days after I took my oral. So I had a really weird career path. And it's as much as anything because the teacher's college, it was run by somebody named, at that time, the president, when I was made a professor and became chair, was the president was Larry Kremen, and I knew him from, he was the closest friend of one of our friends, and I used to sit around a swimming pool with him, and he knew I was very smart. And so he, I mean, I don't mean to sound immodest, but, you know, I'm fairly smart. And so he had encouraged me to come to Teachers College when I was trying to choose between going there and to another program. And he said, oh, come to Teachers College. You'll end up being chair of the program before I'd ever started. So the thing, but the truth is that if it had been one of the land-grant colleges that was sort of beholden to Big Ag, you know, as they are, the land-grant colleges who get their research money from Big Ag.
Right.
I have friends who've been at those universities, and they have a very hard time if they try to speak out. I mean, they get really, really clobbered. I had a friend who ended up after graduation at the University of Nebraska, and during the crisis when we were short of, there was a food crisis, and she suggested that we eat less meat. Well, boy, did she hear about that. So I got to be who I was because I was at a school that didn't really know anything about those political issues. It was sort of, Teachers College in Columbia were not at all related to agriculture or the land grant schools. And they read what I wrote, and they thought it made sense, which it did, to anybody who wasn't brainwashed. And so they, you know, they thought it was fine. I mean, I was certainly popular. I was speaking all over the country, and I was getting press. And I mean, that isn't usually a good thing. It isn't always a good thing if you're a professor, but it was not a bad thing. I was getting good press. And then at some point, interestingly enough, early in my career at Teachers College, when I was still a student, I had testified in front of Congress about television advertising to children and how this junk was being advertised to children. And a head of a food company sent a letter to the dean at Teachers College and said, who is this person? She's just a student. She has never studied advertising. How can she, you know, how can she do this? And the dean wrote back and said, you must have never heard of academic freedom. And I heard about it. I got that letter. You know, he sent me a copy of the letter. So I felt like I was very protected, and I was. You know, it was great. I could do what I felt was the right thing. And I was very responsible. I mean, I'd worked at Time Magazine, and I knew exactly what a fact was, and I knew not to say things that you couldn't prove. And so, you know, nobody ever caught me out lying or telling something that wasn't true. They just found me disruptive.
Yeah, but what was the things that, you know, the nutritionists, the thorn in the side of nutritionists, was a quote that I saw, and I just thought, well, why were they so resistant to, you know, hearing new things like this?
To be honest, I think that's a slightly misleading quotation because I think, I mean, when I did my testimony and it got published about television advertising, and it got published, which scared me to death because that really outed me, I got all these letters from dietitians saying, thank you for finally saying something. They were just, I mean, most, too many people in the field were either working for food companies or working for hospitals and clinics and so forth that were beholden to food companies and who would get the kind of letter that was sent to my dean, you know, who couldn't afford to do that. So they were afraid of doing it, but they all invited me to come and speak because they really liked my message. So I was a thorn in the side of the food industry. I met somebody once from General Foods who was, I guess, my age or something, and somehow we became friends. And she said, oh, well, they're never going to invite you to General Foods. You'll never get invited there. And I said, no, I know, that's okay.
Well, you know, still, though, you know, the feeding web was all about introducing to dietitians and nutritionists this idea of, no, you know what? Nutrition doesn't start just in your throat or on the plate. It actually starts in the mm-hmm. soil. And that mm-hmm. seemed to be very controversial as well. That actually, I mean, I think some of our listeners might be shocked to hear that at a point in time, nutrition was never considered, you know, like how the food was grown. Is that right? I mean,
Listen, Teresa, don't even put it in those terms. I want you to know that the Society for Nutrition Education, which has just recently been presidented by one of my a former student of mine and is now presidented by the person I teach with, I mean, it right now is being headed by two very liberal people. The journal put out a call for papers about food waste. And the paper started out by saying, well, most food waste occurs at the level of agriculture, and of course that's not part of our field. So there's a whole push still against including everything from the sea to the table in the field of nutrition. I mean, it's just not yet completely accepted, which is insane. I mean, you know, let's face it, it just really is.
I'm so surprised. I just assumed that, of course, everyone now, you know, the feeding web was certainly one of the first to really point out that connection.
Well, disciplines have their boundaries, and, you know, the boundaries are very strong. I mean, years ago, when we had the world food crisis in 1975, I can remember I was reading the Journal of Clinical Nutrition, the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and somebody wrote in and said, and they published this letter, somebody wrote in and said, you know, the four horsemen of the apocalypse are out there, and I don't see anything in your journal about world hunger or food supply or anything like that. And the editor wrote back, and he said, that's not our field. That's the field of the food demographers or the population people or whatever, but that's not our field. So even though you're in the field of nutrition and there's hunger around the world and there's a problem with food supplies, you do not comment on it because it's not your field.
Yeah, well, you know, this certainly begs the question, and that is, you have been around for a long time in this food movement, and yes, so many people credit you for, you know, being this, quote, matriarch of the eat local, think globally. But what have you seen in all of this work that you've done for the last 50 and 60 years that has changed? And, you know, what you've just said something that hasn't, and that is that, you know, we still are seeing nutritionists not going all the way back to the soil, but have you seen any really positive movement or change?
Well, I have a feeling. I can't prove this. I mean, I don't see many courses around the country. It's not that I follow this closely, so, but you know, that are covering the ground that mine does. There are in environmental programs, there tend to be more programs that might touch on food as part of an environmental program, since it's, you know, obviously a major part of what we're trying to keep the environment intact for. I think that COVID, with the breakdown of the food system that happened under COVID, and it really happened back here. I mean, I'm sure you had the same thing we had. The breakdown of the food system, which included toilet paper and the sort of toilet paper rush that went on here for a while, and the things that we were out of, and the breakdown of the meat supply system because of the COVID in the slaughterhouses and all that. All those things have awakened the public generally to the fragility of the food supply and to the whole issue of, quote, the food supply, which the profession has not tended to pay attention to. I mean, that's what I'm saying. What's really strange is years ago, I've been following ever since, so it hasn't changed. The Journal of Nutrition Education has now been out, I guess it's now, is it 50 years? I can't believe that. But anyway, at some point, I went over and looked in the entire journal to that point, which was at least 20 years. There was one article about the food supply. That most of the articles were about ways of teaching, ways of reaching certain groups, the nutritional status of certain groups and their habits in relation to that. None of the articles were about the difficulty of choosing from this absurd food supply, which was where I started. I mean, that's how I got into this, of saying, my God, what is this that's happened between the time I left college in 1950, having not shopped in a supermarket with my mother since 1946 when I went away to college, right, and then came to New York and lived in New York and finally moved to the suburbs, and so 12 years after I had last shopped in the supermarket, I was back shopping in the supermarket, and when I was born, there were 800 items. By 1970, there were 8,000 items. There are now about 40. And I was stunned. I mean, going back into the supermarket, I was just stunned by what was there. And I thought, this is that's what started me on the whole thing, so that when I entered the profession and found that no one was paying attention to that, that's how I got started, sort of, you know, working my way back, because I was already concerned about world hunger. And so then I thought, well, you know, what about this ridiculously wasteful food system? But it's like when I looked at the 20 years of the journal, not one of the articles, one article in 20 years was about the food system, and that was my article, some article that I had written. So, and it's pretty much still true. I mean, that journal pretty much does not have articles that have anything to do with the food system. They have to do with who we teach, how we teach, what we teach. You know, it's all that kind of stuff. Is this curriculum working? Is that curriculum working? Is this approach to reducing obesity working? Is, you know, that's what it's all about. It's never, never about what's out there and what people are coping with. It just isn't.
Well, I know, you know, from a lot of the readings that now it's a 10-year-old article by Brian Hallwell, just how many of your students are activists now and are really following in your footsteps. So you actually probably have made a big difference in bringing a little bit more awareness about this important topic of the fragility of the food supply. So it's surprising that there isn't more about it.
But you see, you're up against the largest industry in the United States. The food industry is the largest industry in the United States. They don't want to ask those questions. They were happy to have us teach about nutrients. They're happy to have us teach, quote, nutrition, which is all about nutrients and how they interact in the body and how they interact in health and wellness and all that kind of thing. They're happy to don't teach about foods, because if you teach about food, you start to ask questions about all that crap in the supermarket. Is those really foods? I mean, one of the really interesting things that has happened recently, and I wish I was going to be alive long enough to see how it really plays out. I don't know that I can hang on that long. There's a Spanish researcher named Monteiro who has classified foods as foods, processed foods, and ultra-processed foods. And he has a definition of ultra-processed foods, which is basically foods that are not made from foods. They're made from raw materials. You know, their huge proportion of what's in the supermarket is ultra-processed foods. And the last count, 60% of what Americans eat is ultra-processed food. And they've now started doing studies, looking at the health, looking at various things in relation to the number, you know, the proportion of ultra-processed foods in the diet. And man, that is going to really create havoc, because we've never been able to actually say what you're creating is death. You know, we haven't been able to say that, even though this stuff is making, I mean, look at our health statistics. We have terrible health statistics, and we have very, you know, the life expectancy of 21-year-old men in this country, the last time I looked, was well below that of, I like 20 or 30 other countries that had a longer life expectancy at 21. We do pretty well at birth because we have these extreme technologies that keep non-viable infants alive, so to speak. But so we don't do so badly at life expectancy from birth, but we do really badly with life expectancy from 21-year-old males.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today, you're listening to a show produced by Heartland Stories, a weekly radio show exploring food, farming, and public health.
If you're just joining us, we are speaking with Dr. Joan Di Gussaw, who is Professor Emeritus of the School of Nutrition and Education at the Teachers College at Columbia University. Can you believe Dr. Gussaw is 91 years old and is still teaching a dynamic class on nutritional ecology? Well, you know, the food technologists of the world, and they have their own association, And taking a look, though, at obesity, the diabetes, I mean, and actually now childhood cancer is huge. And our sponsor, the Heartland Study, is actually taking urine samples from pregnant women and then the infants when they're born. And we have right now in the Midwest, Joan, I don't know if you know this, a 200% increase from like just 10 years ago of pesticides sprayed because of the fact of that there's like 22 super weeds for glyphosate. And so now we've brought back 2,4-D, and that's what's being increased. And the industry has basically, well, as you know, the EPA took all funding away from the impact of pesticides on infants and children.
Right. Well, they're not measuring it in diets anymore. Glyphosate, as I understand it, is not getting measured at all in the food supply.
Yeah, in either is the other new things, the Dicamba, the 2,4-D, which isn't new.
And the Dicamba, which has been terrible.
Horrible.
Terrible. Yeah, destroyed all the crops around it. I mean, because it's so volatile and they can't stop it. That whole Dicamba story is really shocking. Shocking,
because the drift is terrible.
Yeah, I know, and they lie about it, and then the Department of Agriculture claim they can't prove it, and that, you know, or the people just misread the thing or misused it. It was not really the fault of the thing, and apparently I read several years ago a study where they actually put dicamba in a bowl standing on the ground in a patch of corn or something of soybeans, I can't remember what, and waited for a hot day. And it was just sitting there on the ground, and it volatilized and killed everything, you know. So it's not like it's a mistake. it's the characteristic of the stuff.
You know, Joan, though, you have spent 50 plus 60 years just trying to get some of this information out there. You're in the business of, you know, empowering people with information, which I think is so important, because when you're empowered with information, you feel like you can work through solutions. When we try to talk about obesity, talk about diabetes and so on, especially with the food insecure people of color who are suffering worse than anyone, what do you think is out there that works that we can do more of?
I wish I had a good answer for that, Teresa. The trouble is, I'm too old now. I'm not out there. That's the problem. When I was in the middle of it all, I knew everything that was going on and all the hopeful signs and all the bad signs and everything. I think that one of the most positive signs is the whole thrust about farming while black. I think the whole demand of the people of color community to begin to reclaim agriculture, because when I first began, everyone was explaining to me that African Americans did not want to have anything to do with agriculture because it had to do with, you know, being slaves. So it was not a good idea and not something they were interested in. And there is now, as you know, a really huge movement, and a huge movement to recapture Native American agriculture and Native American foodways. And those are all very positive things, because they're pushing very hard against the general ethic of just picking up what's at the local. They know it's ruined their health, you know. They all know, those people who are involved in the farming movement know it's ruined their health and are doing a lot of educational stuff. So that, I think, is encouraging. I don't know what it takes to dislodge this sort of typical American eater from her habits and to give up, to try to live more simply. It's not something that comes easily to people, because they grew up with those 40,000 items in the supermarket.
You know, you sort of started alluding to this a little bit. I, for example, like to can, but I can't get any canning lids. So, you know, there's people out there all of a sudden who are cooking at home, who are gardening, and who are actually canning, and all the canning lids are gone. But I wanted to ask you, do you think that COVID could be a portal for changing food and food culture?
I've been hoping so. I've certainly been hoping so. Certainly more people have realized that food comes from the ground. There's no question about that. People are starting gardens and, as you say, putting up their own food and that sort of thing. And I wrote a piece for our newsletter, for our little newsletter our department writes, and I wrote about the idea that we don't want to get back to normal, because normal was killing the planet. I mean, we can't go back to where we were, because global warming is going to do us in. I mean, that's the problem. I mean, COVID had made people forget global warming temporarily, and meanwhile, the planet is coming apart. So I'm hoping that people will wake up to the whole mess we've created, and that we'll turn around not only the food system, but what we're doing to the planet, because that's where the real issue lay. I mean, we're not going to have time to kill ourselves with food if we don't do something about everything else, right?
What about the flip side? You know, as someone who's been around for a while and seen a lot of things, what is the dark side, you think, of the coronavirus, and what should we be afraid of?
I'm afraid this is going to happen over and over again, because we're moving into parts of the planet where we encounter in a vivid way all kinds of wildlife with all kinds of viruses, and I think it's going to come again. And, you know, we know the president dismantled the thing that was set up to prepare for it. He fired the scientists who were working in China, working ahead of... I mean, the more you hear, the more you realize everything has been dismantled.
I wanted to just ask you, you know, your age is considered the highest risk. You know, what do you think about COVID, and who are the people who are the most at risk?
Well, I mean, at first people were like, wouldn't come within feet of me for fear of killing me. And now they realize, you know, that I don't, not, I'm not, knock wood, I don't get sick. I just don't. I have had one cold in the last 5 years, maybe. So I think I have a pretty good immune system, and I think it's because I'm outdoors and I eat a lot of dirt in the course of it. I think I'm in pretty good shape, and people are less worried now. But surely there are, I mean, when they talk about older people, it's not only older people, but so many older people have existing, pre-existing conditions. I mean, they're either obese, or they have high blood pressure, I don't have any of those pre-existing conditions. I'm very, very healthy 91-year-old person. So I don't feel like I'm in particular danger. You know, I feel like what that's about is it's about the usual medical condition of older people who usually have a lot of different things that they're taking. I mean, I take no drugs, you know, except blood pressure medication pill. So that makes me totally different than most people. So I'm sure older people are at risk because most older people in this country are not healthy.
You know, Joan is 91, and if you want to get there too, grow your own food, eat healthy, and be healthy, and you will lower your risk.
And keep moving, even when you don't feel like it.
Yeah, and go outside and be outside. But I can't possibly leave this interview, Joan, unless I ask you about your garden. And are you still plagued with woodchucks?
I have not had a woodchuck this year. Last year, I had a disastrous couple of years, and I don't know what's happened. It looked like the groundwater was coming up because my soil was so wet, even when it wasn't raining. It was just sopping wet, and everything practically died. So I thought I was finished gardening, and so I've been very cautious in my planting, like of potatoes, which normally you have to dig deeply, so I can't plant them deeply. But somehow this year, for whatever reason I cannot explain, I think it has to do with the person next door who had a sprinkler system that, believe it or not, this giant empty house, but then they had an automatic sprinkler system that would be sprinkling in rainstorms. And I think that because the lawn bed, it's just a piece of lawn, and it's sodded, and I think it was sodded over probably a clay base, and I think when he poured all that water on it, it would just run down onto my property. You know, just the slope was in my direction, and it would just... So I think that was part of it, and since nobody's been turning on those sprinklers this year, I haven't had that problem. So I've had really... This has been quite a wonderful year in terms of my productivity. So I just dug 6 pounds of potatoes yesterday, and the day before I dug 10 pounds of other potatoes. So
I dug potatoes yesterday too.
Really? That's my favorite thing. Isn't that one of the great things? It's like finding coins along the road.
No, it's like going on a hunt, you know, where you find these beautiful things. I mean, I love it. It's so much fun.
Right, exactly. Yes, it's like walking along the road and seeing a quarter lying there, and then you go down and there are many more quarters underneath.
Well, Joan, as always, such a such an honor and really a pleasure to be speaking with you. And thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your wisdom with us. It's just fantastic to be able to, you know, have a mentor like you who has had so much experience and such a depth of knowledge.
Well, thank you, Teresa.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to Heartland Stories interview with Joan Gussaw. Sprouts theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact Ursula Rudenberg at ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
It's 10:30 a.m., so, of course, it's time for film at 11 here on KBOO Community Radio Portland. This week we have some special takes on European art films and examples of key thrillers. So let's first turn to our Los Angeles correspondent, Jeff Godsell, another essential of cinema, in this case, a foundational horror film.
It's pretty widely acknowledged now that Universal Studios was the home of horror films back in the 30s and 40s, but it wasn't so apparent back in early 1931. Certainly, studio head Carl Laemmle knew the potential that the genre had. After all, he had seen Lon Chaney score big at the studio with the silent classics, The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Phantom of the Opera. But no one could have foreseen the beginning of a franchise or the spark plug of more to come.